Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show still archived at cinematica.co.nz. I expect you to sing along now.
Oh, Canada, our home and native land.
Yep, it's the special Canadian edition of the show.
I've even got my Tim Hortons mug.
Yep.
And, nice. And Mum, I had to explain Tim Hortons to Dan, so I'm, you know, spreading what the knowledge.
Yeah, I just thought it was a coffee cup.
No.
So,
it's a legend.
Canada Day is which actual day?
July 1st.
July 1st, which is what? Well, by the time most people listen
this
to the show, like the day after
Canada
tomorrow.
Canada Day episode.
It is, and not only is it timed perfectly for Canada Day, but we have a Canadian film and a film with a lot of Canadians in it.
So,
all in all, I think that that's every reason to celebrate our Commonwealth and Dominion partners across the ocean. So, yay for Canada. But let's get on with the show.
Yeah, grab yourself a glass of Canadian Club on some ice, Don Draper style. Let's get into it.
In today's episode of the show, oh, actually, I didn't do the welcome. Let's start that. Hey, welcome to season 4, episode 11, Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin. Here with me in the studio
is me.
And me. Of course, you heard me singing earlier, so I'm here.
You know, yes, we're all here.
Your mellifluous here. Tones earlier on.
We're here.
Okay, Simon and Kaylee are here. In today's episode, the program for the New Zealand International Film Festival was launched on Monday night. At least the Auckland one was. Wellington gets unveiled tomorrow. That's
and we
Thursday.
Will be there.
We will be there. And I was there in Auckland on Monday to record some of director Bill Gosden's opening remarks and to take the temperature of the room after the first preview screening. So we talked to a few friends of Cinematica who are also there. We'll be featuring that a little bit later on. Meanwhile, back at the multiplex, Seth Rogen, James Franco and Jay Baruchel, that's how you pronounce his name, Baruchel, play themselves at the end of the world in This Is The End. Viggo Mortensen shows off his Spanish in Everybody Has a Plan, and James Cromwell has a plan to build a house for Genevieve Bujold in the Canadian drama Still Mine. So we'll be talking about all of those in the show today, but first, what is in the mailbag? Kaylee, you've been monitoring.
Yeah, we have a good mailbag this week of two-word reviews. Most of them, or not most of them, some of them are about Man of Steel. Sorry, my brain stopped there.
Which hardly any of us have seen. Hands up, who's seen it?
You can't.
Well,
It opens tonight.
Yeah, but some people could. You could. Have you not had your fundraising screenings? You've not had the Wainui table tennis.
Nothing like that. No, I think it's been a bit. You know, I think they've tightened the belt on this one.
Oh dear. So let's start out. Miriam Ruth Ross tweets: "Man of Steel, steely incoherence." Bum, bum. Mm.
Yeah, she's in Scotland at the moment, or Scotland and England doing various 3D-related conference activities. So she's busy telling the academic community about all the things she's learning about 3D, but she's also obviously, in a purely academic sense, making sure that she's catching the Man of Steel in 3D as well. 75% of the screens in the US for Man of Steel were 3D screens.
Right.
Which is pretty intense if you're one of those people that actually can't watch 3D. Makes life pretty difficult.
Yep.
Miramar Mike says, "Man Movies two-word review of World War Z, upsized thriller, fun times was what it was."
Good.
Yeah, and that's a film that I think has actually been getting reasonable responses. Maybe not from critics so much, but certainly audiences seem to be into it.
Outdone though in the US by Despicable Me 2.
Yeah.
Opening, you know, head to head.
And I noticed that the Despicable Me 3 rumors are basically that it's just going to be all minions all the time.
Yes. There's a minion film coming out
In 2016 or something.
Something like that. Yeah. There's a minion movie.
And a shout out to some new followers that we have. Roshni P. and Henley McKeg are now following us. Just got that notification. So
g'day. Brilliant.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Welcome to the family.
All right. And have we got some stats, some figures?
Yes.
Because I'm desperate to know what the number one film
Show
in the country
me the
is.
Money.
What have people been spending their money on this yeah. week? In at number 5, down from 4, The Internship. 4 from 2, After Earth. Opening at 3, This Is the End. Down to 2 from 1, The Great Gatsby. And in the number 1 position, World War Z. Brad Pitt.
Straight in.
And I've read a couple of interesting articles about World War Z and the business side of things and how this is Brad Pitt's biggest, his biggest opening ever. So, you know, from a movie star point of view, he still got it. Whereas I noticed that the latest Arnold Schwarzenegger film gone straight to video. So, you know, Brad Pitt, you know, proving that you can still be a movie star, you know, and pull in those big numbers.
I saw a great Venn diagram someone did of World War Z, the book, and World War Z, the movie, and the only thing in the middle was the title.
Yeah, pretty much, pretty much. Now, Simon, you've been scanning the details of the box office report, and you've got some interesting art house stuff to
Well, you just mentioned Arkles last week, and Remembrance came in there, you know, 9th this week, but 8th last week in the top 10, which is a nice result.
So, two weeks and still in the top 10.
Yeah, which is a nice result, I think.
Yeah, and for people who are interested in our response to Remembrance, if you've seen the poster or the trailer up at your local cinema, you can go back to last week's show and listen to Simon's review, which was a very positive one.
Mm.
So, you've had did I pad
I'm
effectively
ready.
Enough
ready.
For you there? Excellent.
Bring it.
All right.
Seth!
I have the best weekend ever planned.
James Franco's having a giant party.
This place is beautiful, man.
This place is like a piece of me. You two just stepped inside me.
You let us both come inside you. Yeah.
Boom. Thanks, James Franco.
What the?
The sheriff's office is urging people to stay in their homes right now.
I think it's the apocalypse. It's all in here.
And he opened the bottomless pit.
The sinkhole? Every single time I turn on the news, sinkhole in South America, a bunch of South Americans getting sucked into the ground.
Sinkhole de Mayo.
That was a good joke.
It was
the sinkhole de Mayo.
It was a good joke. This is the end. This is a film that I think I might even have mentioned on the show. I saw posters up at the local multiplex for it that didn't tell you anything about what the film was.
It's
really
just
the
faces
just who's in
the,
it.
Yeah, faces on the poster and names of stars, and you're thinking, well, this could be awful. yeah. And so it was a big surprise to me when I finally got to see it on Saturday morning. So, Kaylee, you are going to give us the rundown.
Yeah, so our first Canadian entry today on Cinematica is...
You're going to claim this one. You're going to claim this as a Canadian entry. Really? Really?
Well, this is, like, sadly... Sadly, because you've got Seth Rogen in there, you've got Jay Baruchel, you have Michael Cera as well. It's, you know, a good number.
Mm.
We don't really want it, though. so, yeah, this is based on a short film done by Rogen, Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel in 2007 called Jay and Seth versus the Apocalypse, which I had seen, which was quite funny and short. This, on the other hand, is much longer. It is funny. I did laugh. And I was so into it, I didn't even get up to go to the bathroom because I was worried I was going to miss something.
Is that not common?
Right. Yeah, is that a regular thing for a film?
Well, there are, I believe
it's the bladder test.
I spoke about it on the show, I think, earlier this year that I did actually go up and leave to go to the bathroom in one film because I just liked it so much. But I did stick around for this. But the more I think about it, the less I sort of loved it. Even though I was really entertained at the time, I think there's a lot of content issues that I'm still struggling a bit with. But if you know Seth Rogen, you sort of know what you're getting into. I mean, this is within the movie, because it's the end of days and they're worried they're going to never make another film again, they make a sequel to Pineapple Express. And that's actually a great moment in the film when they're making a film within a film.
So what is the premise? Like, maybe if you could take a step back and for those people who like me only were aware of the poster image.
Yes.
What on earth is going on in this film?
So Jay Baruchel comes to L.A. to stay with Seth and have a weekend, a bros weekend together. Right.
They're playing themselves.
Every actor plays themselves in this film. And James Franco has just finished building this great, big, very secure house. And he's having a big housewarming party. And every celebrity is there. You have Rihanna. You have Emma Watson. All these people that are there that you'll recognize from film and television. And then the apocalypse comes. And they're trying to decide what's going on. Some people think it's a zombie invasion. Jay Baruchel thinks it's the end of days. And it seems like an alien invasion when it first starts because people are being sucked up by beams up into the sky. There's fires. There's demons. There's dragons. It's just all going off, really. And we are left with this group of sinners who have not yet been taken to heaven.
No, that's right, and that's sort of the point, isn't it? Is that basically there are these guys? These are still very much immature, boysy Hollywood movie stars with entitlement issues, shall we say, who are left wondering why it is that they haven't been taken to heaven, you know. Well, there must be something wrong with the way that they live their lives, but they
or heaven.
Yeah, they can't turn it around though, can they? They you know, they try and work out what would a good person be like, and they can't do it.
No. And while the world is ending outside of James Franco's compound, they're having a pretty good time inside.
Until the food runs out.
Until the food runs out. And Joan Hill becomes possessed, and then the whole house lights on fire.
Doesn't Hermione sort them out?
Yeah. Because at the beginning, because they're at the party and then everyone runs outside during an earthquake. And if you're nervous about earthquakes, it's a pretty scary scene. Like, everything's shaking and it freaked me out, to be honest.
I'm not sure if you meant to run outside, though.
No, but that's people in LA. They don't know they're not trained the way that we are.
So they all run outside and this giant sinkhole opens and everyone falls into it. But somehow Hermione survives and comes back to stay with them, but then just ends up robbing them instead and running off because she doesn't want to stay with them because they're horrible.
They are. She comes across pretty well, actually, doesn't she, Emma Watson? You think she would be a good person in a crisis?
I'd stick with Emma Watson in a crisis. I'd live with her in a storm drain. We'd be fine. We'd be great.
Now, you could argue that there's a certain kind of knowing satire of Hollywood in the same way that films have satirized Hollywood for years, the Day of the Locust or whatever it was, I think. You know, this is hell on earth anyway. This is Sodom and Gomorrah, and these people deserve, you know, they live so appallingly that they deserve everything they get. So there's a certain sort of knowing quality about it. You said you had some problems with some of the content, though.
Yeah, it's the...
Bearing in mind, you know, what these guys are like.
Yeah, bearing in mind, I know what these guys are like, but it's the sexual violence and all the sexual jokes just got a bit too much after a while. It's like, yeah, haha, dick jokes are funny, and James Franco is this giant, like, penis sculpture, and one of the guys sleeps under it. It's like this penis tent, and haha, it's funny. But it just sort of was like, okay, like, can we have something funnier?
I think the point maybe you're grasping for there is that when Emma Watson does arrive, there's a kind of an air of maturity and femaleness that sort of calms everybody down for a little while, and the film takes on a little bit of a different tone. But when it's just the boys together, it is relentlessly self-indulgent. And you know, I sort of don't have a problem with it. I mean, it's an R-rated movie, and that's what these guys do, and they're sending themselves and their personas up, and this is sort of the thing that they're best known for. For me, the most extreme character or example of that was Danny McBride, who we don't necessarily know too much from movies. He's been a sort of second banana in lots of films, Pineapple Express being one of them. And he full credit to him, he plays a pretty dislikable character, a pretty dislikable version of
himself.
That's
what he's good at. His characters are really dislikable, and that's what he's really good at. Like, he's sort of greasy and dumb and
awful. Yeah. I'm a little bit like you in that I felt like, I enjoyed it while I was watching it. I thought I really appreciated the surprise, and I get the feeling that this is a film that will have a bit of a life as people sort of discover it. but I don't really remember very much about it afterwards.
So it's a Big Mac movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. I think that's a really good way of putting it.
You were hungry. You went in there. You had it. It was nice, but you're hungry again.
And I guess my abiding memory is really how game they all are, really, to send themselves up and to send themselves up in such extreme ways. And I just want a big shout out to Channing Tatum.
That was so heartbreaking. We're not gonna
tell you in what form he appears, except good on him, basically, for giving it a go.
And you know what? Go the Backstreet Boys also.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, indeed. Again, we're not gonna tell you in what context they show up, but yeah, no.
My heart skipped a beat.
Right.
I was real excited.
Have you had a chance to think of two words to describe this one?
My two words seem a bit harsh, but it is, you know, I do have to say, though, I mean, we had the storm in Wellington. I'm still without power. I'm sort of homeless. I know how these guys feel. But
it's your, that's
yeah. But I was, but I just thought, like, I was sitting in the theater and I was like, you know what? It just feels good to go to the cinema and just watch something like this and just be totally taken away and just not care and just watch some silly comedy blockbuster. So it did make me laugh out loud, really, really loud in some parts. But I was on thought. So my two words are tragic comedy.
Oh, okay. My two words for This Is the End are theologically dubious. Because... pretty much, if you watch this film thinking that you're going to get any clues as to how to actually survive the apocalypse, and if you're thinking that it's going to give you any clues as to what heaven might actually be like, then probably you're on the wrong track.
I think my heaven will be like that.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of booty. There was a lot of booty.
Is it a booty heaven?
Yeah,
that's what heaven should be.
Well,
booty and blow. There was a lot of booty and blow.
I don't remember that bit. What was going on with Michael Cera? What was that?
That was pretty funny. That was pretty funny. The nicest guy in Hollywood turns out to be the nastiest. Yeah. So, again, full credit for, you know, selling it so well. Yeah. On Monday night, on Monday afternoon, I flew up to Auckland so that I could – I was so excited about the launch of the film festival program that I wanted to be there for the first of the launches. There are two, ladies and gentlemen. So at the Rialto Cinema in Newmarket in Auckland, all the great and the good of the Auckland film community gathered so that they could hear Bill Gosden announce – some of the highlights out of, you know, actually it's a very big program. It'll be about 150 plus films in there. So he outlined some of the highlights and then we all went off to watch a film, and we had a choice of three films to watch because they couldn't fit everybody into. They don't have really big cinemas like we have down here in Wellington. They had to sort of separate us out. So some people went to see the Sarah Polley film Stories We Tell, which I saw at Telluride. Did I mention that I'd been to Telluride last year? You're Next, which is a horror film that's part of the incredibly strange component of the program that played in one cinema. And I got to see a film called The Rocket, which was made it's an Australian film technically, but made in Laos. And that was a film that I ended up watching it because it was like the last one standing. I didn't want to watch a horror film, and I'd already seen the Sarah Polley. So I'll go and watch this. And I'm so glad I did. It was really, really good. So what we're going to do is we're going to play some bits of that I recorded while I was there. First of all, Bill Gosden talking a little bit about highlights from the program. And then after the screenings, I got to talk to various people, various friends of Cinematica about their impressions of what they'd seen and of the program that had just been handed out.
One of the films we targeted and which fell into place at the very last moment, appropriately enough, was the film that we thought would make an ideal closing night film, and that's Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive. That came to us at the very last moment because we approached the distributor of the film, and he quickly found out that all festival appearances of the film had to be personally approved by Jim himself. So we were on tenterhooks, but we had a pretty good record where Jim Jarmusch was concerned, having been there right from the start. So I was absolutely delighted to hear just at the moment we were closing off the programme that Jim Jarmusch decided that the New Zealand International Film Festival was indeed cool enough to screen the movie. We're very excited about the premieres of the Cannes films, of course, and many of these will be ex-Cannes premieres that won't have shown anywhere else before they get here, which is just a wonderful piece of serendipity, really, in terms of our place in the calendar. It's great that we can continue to secure these films so quickly. The films we've secured the most quickly of all, of course, the films that we have in their world premieres with us. And we have a fantastic New Zealand lineup this year. It's good to see quite a few filmmakers here tonight will be premiering Fantail, which I think is an exemplary case of what can be done with the New Zealand Film Commission's escalator fund, a very realistic but very full, I think, use of that very small amount of money to make a first feature. Romeo and Juliet, a love song, is just going to look and sound sensational at its world premiere at Civic, as I'm sure will Giselle. Wonderful to see Leon Narby's camera work on a Blu-ray at my house. I can hardly wait to see what it looks like on that screen at the Civic. Zoe McIntosh's The Deadly Ponies Gang, the most difficult film to describe in two sentences that I think we have on this year's program. I just say, go and look at a clip. A truly eccentric and very, very funny film, that the funniest piece of backblocks humor I think we've had in the festival since Florian's Kaikoura Demolition. From further south, much, much further south, and in fact, Anthony Powell's film Antarctica, A Year on Ice, really is an eyeful, an extraordinary piece of work. About 5 or 6 years ago, David Long came into my office and showed me these clips he had on a DVD of these time-lapse sequences that Anthony Powell had shot in the Antarctic. Anthony's somebody who's spent a lot of time working there, I think, spent the better part of 15 years working down at Scott Basin McMurdo, and he devised a camera that could withstand the freezing temperatures and make these amazing time-lapse sequences. The sky above Scott Base in the middle of the winter, just breathtaking stuff, and it looked good on my computer screen. And then finally Anthony, after so many years, got his film made, and we went out to Park Road Post a couple of months ago and saw it, and it's just jaw-dropping. It really is a ravishing film, and also an incredibly amusing insight into what it's like to live down there, particularly to winter over down there. I'll also mention another great New Zealand film, which will be having its world premiere, in fact, in Wellington. Fittingly enough, it will screen here a day or so later, and that's Utu Redux. Jeff Murphy has taken the opportunity to revisit his great 1983 film. As many of you probably already know, the film was recut by the producers into a so-called international version quite soon after it was first released in New Zealand cinemas. And Jeff has taken the opportunity, with the assistance of his DOP, Graham Cowley, to go back and reconstitute something that's even better in many ways than the original New Zealand release version. It really is a wonderful film, and that too, in a beautiful new digital restoration, is going to be quite something to see at the Civic.
Hey, Michael Oliver from Mad Men. Welcome to Cinematica. We finally got you on the show.
That's right.
And what have you just seen?
I saw The Rocket.
Oh, right. Is that one of yours?
No, it's not. I don't think it's got distribution, actually.
Oh, wow. What did you think?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, very authentic, different part of the world I've not seen before. It was really very, very sweet.
And a heartwarming story, but with plenty of grit to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved it. Yeah, it was really great.
Steve Austin, welcome to Cinematica. If I can tear you away from your program for just a moment.
Yeah, well, I've got to have a look, eh?
You already, I saw you jumping for joy a little bit earlier on. What did you spot?
The remake of Bill Lustig's Maniac, starring Elijah Wood, has really caught my attention. It's had a lot of amazing press out of genre film festivals overseas, and I'm expecting amazing things out of it. Yeah, the incredibly strange section is always where I go, so...
Yeah, that's the purple-coloured section of the programme.
Right at the back of the bus, as always.
Yeah.
The Act of Killing is always one that I've heard a lot about, which should be great. The Pussy Riot documentary.
Wasn't expecting that.
Yeah.
What have you just seen?
I just went and saw Your Next, again, back of the bus.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that was Ant Selection. For the triple bill on offer.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic home invasion horror. Kind of reinvents the wheel. Takes the formula, throws it out the window, has fun with it. You're laughing, you're scared the whole time. It's great. Absolutely great.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Looking forward to an absolutely amazing film festival this year.
I'm kind of disappointed. You've only got one copy of the program.
I've got two.
Oh, no, you've got two? Okay. Is that one for keeps and one for highlighting?
One for marking up. Yeah, the spreadsheet's sitting at home all ready to go at the moment. So as soon as I get home, I'll work through till about midnight and, you know, start on the rough cut.
Yeah, so you do yours digitally. I know that when they actually program the festival, they still do it on a big sheet of cardboard with pieces of paper being shuffled around.
There's nothing,
like the Battle of Britain.
There's nothing quite like having the festival program in your hand, though, and being able to, you know, colour it and put little stars beside things, and yeah.
Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times, welcome back to Cinematica.
Always a pleasure.
You have been pouring through your film festival program, and of the films that haven't already been announced, like the ones that you've just discovered in the program, which ones are appealing to you?
I think actually, I was going to say Frances Ha. I suspect that has actually already been announced, but I've been reading a lot about Frances Ha, the Noah Baumbach film with Greta Gerwig. So actually,
two names to conjure with.
Very much looking forward to that. Much Ado About Nothing. I don't think I knew that we were getting the Joss Whedon version of that. I've seen a fabulous interview with him about that relatively recently. I'm really looking forward to this, having been a Beatrice in my time in the old high school play.
I was a Don John in
were
the
you?
Summer Shakespeare in 1980.
Oh, it's not quite Benedict, is it? But never
it's
mind.
It's not. I was, and
the story.
Yeah, that's a long story we won't go into here.
I've already got my tickets for Goblin playing Suspiria, the Suspiria soundtrack. I remember seeing Suspiria at a girly sleepover party in my teens, and I've never recovered. So that will be exciting anyway. I already got tickets for that.
You folded over the pages?
I've folded down the corners. Because
is that because you didn't have a highlighter with you?
I didn't bring a highlighter to this gig. No, that was remiss, wasn't it? I didn't know anything about Romeo and Juliet, a love song, let alone that it was a New Zealand film, let alone that I don't know, some people from Cinematica like doing some sort of Q&A or something like that, I've heard. So if that's not a deterrent, I'll probably go see that film.
You could just come along afterwards for that.
I might just come, actually, yeah. Or just like scoot out before the Q&A. That might be the way to go. However, one that I had just noticed and I didn't know anything about, it's in the French film section, and it's, I guess it's called Yapalou or Japalou or something. It's a French film, and it's piqued my interest because William Canet has co-written it and is starring in it. And despite the fact that it seems to have good old Daniel Auteuil again.
There's only about 20 actors in France.
Well, it's got Donald Sutherland as well, as I see here. But it's 130 minutes of William Canet, unless he gets killed off early on. I don't know. True story of a French equestrian show jumper. Not into horses, personally, but...
You're really selling it, you know that.
Well, I still think that this might be fun. So, that's something to look forward to also.
Doug Dillerman, welcome back to Cinematica. It's that time of year, and you've got a fresh mint copy of the festival program in your hand. Have you had a chance to have a look at it yet?
Just very briefly, but I saw Leviathans in there, which has been my number one pick for things that I hope they bring, so I'm thrilled about that. Like Someone in Love, the new Kiarostami film, and I've absolutely been waiting for that for a year plus now. And Ernest and Celestine.
Right, exactly. And also, Bill announced before we went up into the screenings that the Jarmusch was coming back from Cannes, which wasn't in their announcements on Sunday. So that was
a very pleasant surprise, because that's been very highly reviewed, and Only Lovers Left Alive. I'm really looking forward to it. And it looks like it's the closing night film as well, so should be a great night at the Civic. And
How do you plan your festival program? Do you have multiple copies of the program that you some that you mark up? And do you have different highlighter colors?
Oh, God, this is really nerdy. But, you know, you won't be surprised by that. I have a text document, actually, but I have a Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4, and then for future research, I have a new category this year called New Zealand Films, because it's a different set of research. And last year, after missing The Red House, I'm like, I've really got to look into these instead of just writing them off. And then I have the Nope category. So Tier 1 is we'll see no matter what. Tier 2's we'll see unless there's a Tier 1 in the way. Tier 3s, I'll go see if a friend's going or it works out with the schedule. And Tier 4s, I probably won't, but it's on the radar and if people start talking about it. And then it's just like writing it over and over again. I was talking to Steve from Flix and I met him for the first time tonight. I'm like, you know, you need an app. You just need to be like, here's the point value I associate with this film. Here's all the films that I put point values for and maximize. Here's the times that I'm available. Maximize it. Somebody should make an app. Do you write apps?
I don't write apps, but there's somebody's leaving money on the table.
I think so.
Right, yeah. Possibly even the festival.
Yeah, I pay $10 for that app because I'd probably be able to maximize.
Do you take the whole 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks off?
It depends. I'm freelance, so it's kind of what's going. This year it looks like I'm working both weeks, so I'm just going to have to do the best I can to sneak things into my spare time, which just means not getting a lot of sleep and working a lot and fitting it in.
Are you one of those people that, because, you know, we always know, you can look at the program and you go, oh, well, that one will come back. I mean, it's always a gamble. You know, there's no surefire guarantees anymore that films will come back.
Of course.
Are you one of those people that go, well, you know, it's going to come back, but I really got to see this at the Civic? Or do you go hunting for the ones that you think are going to be, this is your one and only chance?
The latter. If it's a choice of something that's a gamble but won't come back, or something that I'm pretty sure will come back. But it's really about something that's a cinematic experience, and that's the most important thing, I guess, in deciding what to see. Something that you're not going to get the chance to have the same experience with, and something that's kind of like that's a pretty good movie. Everybody's fine with it. Yeah, what's for dinner? I'll probably skip words like the new Terrence Malick film or the Jodorowsky film. The Malick film in particular, some people have hated. I might hate it, but it's going to be a cinematic experience, and I'm not going to miss it, because even though Tree of Life bugged the hell out of me at points, I still have memories tattooed on my eyeballs from seeing it at the Civic. And even if there was points during the second half where I was so fed up with it, people will talk about it. You know, Dance of Reality, the Jodorowsky film, is the last night. And, like, you know, it's the same thought that Antichrist and Enter the Void had. And both those films, like, I had major mixed issues with. But hanging outside the Civic afterwards, arguing with friends, is as much value as the film is itself, if not more. And you're not going to get that with your safe place at 3 months at the Lido, and you go see it, and you all agree that it's a pretty good film. And aren't we glad we saw that?
Hugh Lilly, welcome back to Cinematica. You're now the film reviewer for On Film Magazine, which is, prestigious. I wonder who chose you for that job. And what did you see tonight at the...
I saw the Sarah Polley film, Stories We Tell. And as you... I'm pretty sure you know, I despised her previous film. I hated it so much. She's only ever made fiction films, so this is her first documentary. And it's a story about her family and her family's history and her... the different ways that the different people in families tell, two various different families tell various stories about her father. Really interestingly made. There are still things about her as a filmmaker in this that I don't like, but I did really enjoy it. Yeah.
That's good. That's good. And have you had a chance to have a look at the program yet?
I actually haven't had much of a chance, but I was talking to Bill, and I said, are we getting post-tenebrous lux? Because that was meant to be here last year. And he said yes, and I said I hadn't even looked through the program. So that's definitely...
Well, you've just made my night. Because I haven't looked at it either. No, I've been busy talking to other people. Right. So, no, that's very good news.
Very, very exciting.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Well, Hugh,
been looking forward to that for more than a year now.
Indeed. Thanks very much for your time, and we'll catch up with you again on the show soon.
Definitely. See you soon.
Jacob Powell, welcome back to Cinematica. It's a year since the last time you appeared. I think it was at this very occasion.
It certainly was with Lewis Foster.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So you know what I'm going to ask you.
Yep.
And that is, you've got several copies of the program in
your
hands.
They
obviously have to print way more than they actually need, don't they?
Well, you know, people like us, well, at least I'd say for myself, I need a working copy that I make all my notes on, and then another collection copy that I put in store in case the kids grab it and rip it apart.
Right.
And then another spare to pass to the friend who's overseas.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I've got an Auckland one to go with the Wellington one that I'm going to get on Thursday, because they are different. And something that Wellingtonians don't actually always entirely realise is that there are often some gems that are Auckland only. And so I'm going to go through page by page, making comparisons.
Oh, yeah, excellent.
and feeling hurt. So you've had a quick flick through.
Yeah.
What are you most excited about that hasn't perhaps already been announced?
Okay, hasn't been announced, but I've actually had a chance to see via screener Computer Jets.
Oh, right.
Was my most anticipated film of this year. Fantastic, man. It might not appeal to everyone, but it appeals to me on so many levels. Slightly surreal.
Yeah.
I'm a big Bujalski fan, and he's gone in some slightly different directions, and I can't wait to see it on the big screen as well.
I also want to apologise to Darren Bevan, who gave me the best 4-minute soundbite that I could possibly have hoped for. He spoke in perfect, complete sentences. He was brilliantly lucid, very enthusiastic, except that my recorder was on pause the whole time that I was talking to him, and I should have noticed that the red light was flashing. So, Darren, I'm really sorry, but you were great, and we'll get you on the show properly at some point in the future. Me and technology, I'm usually really good at it, except for the first time. Time for some news now.
Jim Carrey seems set to derail his own comeback by coming out publicly against all the violence in his latest film, Kick-Ass 2. Carrey tweeted that he made the film before Sandy Hook, referring to the tragic elementary school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, last December. And now, in all good conscience, I cannot support that level of violence, he tweeted. In the film, Carrey plays a character called Colonel Stars and Stripes, who takes out the bad guys with a combination of fists and a Clint Eastwood growl. I thought this was really interesting. I saw this tweet yesterday.
And so there is some doubt as to whether this is a publicity stunt on the part of Carrey and the makers of the film, because it certainly has generated a lot of attention. Because Carrey is, he can be a bit eccentric in his pronouncements. You know, he's anti-vaccine and various other sort of crazy stuff. And it'll be interesting to know. I'm kind of with him on this one, because I saw the first Kick-Ass and thought that the violence in that was over the top and kind of unnecessary, or maybe not unnecessary. Apparently, according to the producers and the people who produced the comic book, the original comic book, it's totally necessary.
Mm.
It is the point, except it was too much for me, that first one. Yeah. So
I haven't read the comic books, but I'm guessing they are in that same vein, very violent and grown up, and a lot of blood and splatter, because some of the comic books I read are very, very mature. One of them, which they're planning on, is licensed or whatever it's called, to be made into a film, and I have no idea how they're going to do that.
Right. Yeah, because
I didn't think it was
Kick-Ass
terribly violent.
I had a real problem with Hit Girl, actually.
Yeah.
I had, and not so much with Hit Girl, the character, but there's a scene at the end of the first Kick-Ass where Hit Girl takes a bit of a beating from the villain. And
that's true. I mean, there's that part. But
that made me feel really, really awkward. And possibly that was the intention. And if so, well, good on them for provoking that response. But I think what I was supposed to do was go, yay when, you know,
when,
for the finale. But by that time, I was feeling really ill.
But there's certainly any number of films out there with similar sorts of violence in them.
You're absolutely right.
It really was extreme and lifted the bar a hell of a lot.
But the violence was shared among all the characters as well. Mm.
Yeah, but I sort of don't mind it when it's grown ups, you know. Mm. And that was something particularly creepy about that. But you're right. Mm. So many films have violence in them. So many films have some kind of variation between cartoonish violence and the kind of violence where people are really genuinely getting hurt.
Mm.
And so we were talking about ratings recently and how in order to not get an R rating in the US, they can't have blood in films. That's the sort of the line that they draw. And so World War Z, which is a zombie movie, has mm-hmm. almost no actual horror in it at all. It mm. just got, it's got moments that make you jump.
And Lord of the Rings, the blood is all like black or grey.
That's right.
It's not red.
Yeah. And so you've got these sorts of issues where the violence in those films is actually toned down to the extent where you don't even realize that it's violence.
Yeah, which is kind of worse in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, it's just, oh, it's not going to the deer and getting your paper.
That's right. Yeah. Whereas you're still recovering from film you saw this morning. Right?
I am. It's been burnt through my eyeballs right into my brain and it's not coming out. I can still see stuff.
Are you allowed to say what it is?
I don't know, to be honest, so I won't.
Mm. Okay. No, fair enough, because the last thing we want to do is get anybody into trouble. But it's an interesting comparison, isn't it? Because that's a film that is the violence is its reason for his existence, you know,
and it's just too real for my liking. It's just too brutal.
So we all have the things that push us beyond where we're comfortable. I'm sure there are audiences that will watch that and you know, not have a problem with it at all.
Well, then they need help.
Mm. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to Kick-Ass 2 because I thought it was a fantastic film. The first one was fantastic.
Yeah, I
just because
awesome.
It's so stylized and what, it just
does
really...
it have a subtitle? Is it Kick-Ass? Yeah, Kick-Ass 2. Kick-Ass is.
I don't know. Not yet.
Okay.
But
maybe. But I think Hit Girl is like the main focus in this one. She's going to get her vengeance.
Right.
Because
okay.
Daddy is gone. Moving on.
Yeah.
In a story we have been following closely here at Cinematica, a director has finally been found for 50 Shades of Grey. Dun, 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 dun. Nowhere.
Dirk Diggler.
Nowhere Boys. Sam Taylor Johnson, also known as Sam Taylor Wood. Okay, Wood and Johnson are both the same thing. Like
Johnson!
I hadn't thought of that.
Sam Taylor, something that doesn't sound like that.
Okay.
50 Shades,
but the reason why she's called Sam Taylor Johnson is because she is now married to Aaron Johnson, the star of Nowhere Boy.
Oh.
They met on Nowhere Boy. And yes, and Kick-Ass, exactly. And there's what 23 years between them in age, so yes, she was Sam Taylor Wood and she's now Sam Taylor Johnson, and he is
Sam
Aaron
Taylor Johnson Wood.
And he is Aaron Taylor Johnson now. He's taken her name, so that yeah, so it's all a little bit modern.
I was gonna say quite modern. Like, finally, in sad news, two notable passings. Lau Kar Lung? Lung? Oh, what? I don't even know. The director of Shaw Brothers classic martial arts movies like 36 Chamber Shaolin and 8 Diagram Pole Fighter. Which
isn't that the best title ever?
That sounds amazing. I have a friend who does pole athletics, who's this tiny little like Asian woman, and that sounds like her name. She's amazing. He was 76 years old
and was still working on like fight choreography and stunt management and all sorts of stuff till relatively recently. Those films are of the 70s. Those Shaw Brothers films are still right up there as the martial arts movies.
I want to be kicking butt till my last days. I want to. Yeah, I need to start doing something.
And you're going to start on Wellington Electricity, aren't you?
Yeah. <That's right. laughs>
Talk nicely to them, so they'll never turn up.
No, you're going to go. I'm going to go kick ass on your power butt.
I can't. I just have to sit there and wait, like everybody else.
Well, we were talking about this a little bit earlier on. Are they fixing people's power in Wellington in order of the calls that they received, or the number of children, or the number of dialysis machines, or is it because you are young and relatively healthy that you are still waiting?
Yeah, because it's not an emergency. I suppose, because they didn't call saying that, oh, my cat is going to die. They basically just told me, they gave me a call number and said, well, you're just going to have to wait because lots of other people don't have power, so stop crying about it.
Mm.
Anyway.
Go off the grid, man. You just got to get off the grid.
Go to the movies.
Yeah, and get off the grid.
Yeah.
Don't contribute to that bill anymore.
Jeez. Anyway, moving on. Richard Matheson, the author of novels and screenplays that gave us films like I Am Legend, The Incredible Shrinking Man, and Vincent Ward's What Dreams May Come, passed away yesterday at the age of 87.
And an absolute stone-cold legend. Like when people throw that word around lightly, but yeah, Richard Matheson. I Am Legend story has been filmed 3 times, you know. Mm. So people keep going back to his ideas, people keep going back to his books and the screenplays that he wrote. So much influence on the modern culture. So, you know, if it encourages people to go on Wikipedia Richard Matheson and find out a little bit more, that would be super good, I reckon. So thanks very much for the news. And it's time to, where are we? So it's time to go and visit Canada, as if we haven't had enough Canada already.
What do you think would have happened to us if we'd never met?
Oh, we probably would have found someone else.
You think?
No. Hey, Dad, how'd the checkup go?
Clean bill of health for both of us.
Doctor didn't say anything about her memory?
I forgot to ask him. I was thinking of building us something smaller, more manageable.
We don't have the money.
You absolutely certain you want to do this, old man?
Age is just an abstraction, not a straitjacket.
Mr. Morrison, there are a number of building code violations.
You're telling me that my material is substandard?
There is zero leeway on this. Deal with the violations, or I will bulldoze this place.
Golly. Based on a true story, apparently, according to the trailer. This is a film that I have not seen. Mm-hmm. So we're going to throw across to our Canadian correspondent who can tell us where this fits into the context of modern Canadian life.
Yes. Well, it is set in rural New Brunswick in the east of Canada, and it's about an aging couple and James Cromwell, who stars, known from Babe. The Babe series is a farmer, and also he was in The Artist and many other things. Very long film career. He and his wife are living together, and he decides he wants to build a new house on their farmland because his wife is falling ill, and I believe she's getting Alzheimer's because she's starting to forget things and, you know, is having trouble getting around their two-story house. Decides to build this one-story house for her so they can live out their golden years together, and comes up against all this bureaucracy and he isn't meeting the codes and the standards for the building and the city.
He seems a bit stubborn.
He is very stubborn.
Because actually, filling out a bit of paperwork is probably not the end of the world, I wouldn't have thought.
But it's more than just filling out paperwork. It's like he fills out the paperwork and then he has to get plans drawn up. But he's been building houses for years because his father taught him and his father taught him. And then they come by and he has his own sort of mill, and he makes all the timber himself for the house. And they come by and said, hasn't been stamped. This isn't certified timber. They just keep trying to stop him building this house, and he just keeps building it because he needs somewhere for him and his wife, who's falling ill, to live. And it's a really lovely story. It's so Canadian. It's like one of those films it's just, I don't know, there's something about it that I can always tell, like, this is definitely a Canadian film.
And
like,
it's not just the people who are in it, because a lot of the people aren't Canadian.
No, they're not. They're
so what is it about the Canadian, what is it feel? Is it?
It's sort of like a feel and a look. It's based on a true story about someone trying to just do what they want and sort of live their life and go against the government.
See, I had this idea that was a very American sort of attitude, that sort of independent spirit, and that the Canadians were much more
toe the line.
Yeah. A little less likely to rock the boat. Is that not the case?
That's not the case.
Okay. Well, no. That's good to know.
Toe the line. What?
Stick it to the man, eh?
Yeah. We just do it in a much friendlier tone. We don't yell. Right. We're just we're not paying that fine. And I'm going to build this house.
And they probably won't bomb people either. You'll just go, okay then.
Yeah.
So.
That's what Canadians do, isn't it?
Yeah, well, actually, it's, you can sort of put up with almost anything if it's done with a friendly, sort of cheery
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's so many hooses and aboots. Yeah, it just made me feel so good watching it. It's like, oh, these are my people.
But when this would be a while since he's had a role like this where he's dominated the script, the screen the whole time.
As a lead, I think he's often, you know, playing character parts, isn't he, nowadays, which is, I think, a sign of age, you know, and the fact that he was never a leading man to begin with. In fact, I mean, I don't remember seeing him ever before Babe, and was incredibly surprised when I found out that he was an American actor to begin with. It's like, wow, that accent was really good. So he's turned that into quite a long career, but not too much in the way of lead action. And does he hold this thing on his shoulders, or is it shared around a bit?
No, it's mostly based on his sort of character and moving forward and building this house and just doing what he wants and not giving in to these newfangled ways. He's just going to build this house like his father taught him to do and just going to do it. I don't think I'm selling it very well, but it's actually a really, really lovely film. It's obviously quite sad when you have a film about an elderly couple and one starts to fall ill. I wouldn't say it's quite as shocking as Amour was. Have you seen Away From Her by
yes.
Sarah Polley?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Cause it's like a similar story going on there as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm. So, yeah. So somewhat, I would say, without seeing it, in that vein. But it is really one of those just like really nice rainy day. It's quite soft film that just gets to your heart. You just want to cheer for them. And you know, they're so in love. And it's just such a nice film.
Simon, this film's arrived in New Zealand pretty much unheralded. Like, I hadn't heard of it before it showed up in cinemas this week, really. And not much pre-promotion and not much of a reputation. Have audiences responded to it, as far as you can work out, this weekend?
Yeah, I think they have. I mean, it's been a limited release, but in locations it's playing, and I think it's sort of ticking over. It's one of those films that will do that. It won't, you know, come along and trumpet itself and be loud and really loud at the start. But it should, that audience finds those films and supports them, but they don't rush out. They just tick along.
Okay. So still mine. I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to try and catch up with it this weekend based on your recommendation, Kaylee. Have you come up with two words, do you think?
Yes. My two words for Still Mine are pastoral romance.
Nice. Mm. Nice work. Okay. Now that does sell it. And we've been to Los Angeles, Hollywood, and Canada, and it's time to go to Argentina now.
¿A vos te está pasando algo? ¿Hay algo que no me hayas dicho?
¿De cuándo te deja la tía? ¿Qué se debe la visita? Necesito que me ayudes. De plata.
Capaz que sería mejor en la isla. Allá nadie pregunta nada, todos son muy discretos.
Contó Rubén que te reformaste.
All right, talking of limited releases, this is a film that I, again, wasn't aware of before this weekend before it showed up in cinemas. It's won't be that easy to track down. It'll be at the more independent of your local art houses, I expect. It's called Everybody Has a Plan, and it's a first feature film from an Argentinian director. And if you're a fan of Viggo Mortensen, and lots of people are, then this is going to be right up your alley, because not only do you get Viggo, but you get two times Viggo, because he's playing identical twins.
What?
Yeah.
I'm going tonight.
And they're both, well, one's sort of kind of darker side to it.
Yeah, it's
he?
A classic sort of evil twin sort of arrangement. And I my doubts were, you know, I know he's a really gifted actor, but I was thinking, you know, really? A whole film in Spanish? And I looked up some details about him before the film, and I realized that he's totally fluent in Spanish, and he writes poetry in Spanish. Mm-hmm. Like, Spanish is not a problem, pas de problème.
He's multilingual. French. He's a fantastic, fascinating and fantastic person.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, right, so you can put that aside, and he totally believable in terms of the Spanish language stuff. He plays two characters, these twin brothers, one of whom is a pediatrician in Buenos Aires. He's living this sort of modern urban life, and his brother, who's sort of on the wrong side of the tracks, is still back in the village on the little island where they grew up, and he's got into some trouble because a kidnapping that he's been involved in has gone wrong. He's also very sick and is basically looking for some help. So he turns up in the city, and there's this great scene between the two of them, both, of course, played by Viggo, and again, you know, with that kind of presumably digital but totally seamless sharing of the screen between the one actor playing both parts. This is only about 15 minutes into the film, but already I have to stop because there's, you know, you really don't want to know what happens next, except that there's a resolution of some kind, which means that good Viggo, the doctor, ends up going back to the village, back to the island where they grew up, and pretends to be his brother. And of course, he doesn't know anybody, doesn't know what his brother did there, and of course, he doesn't know the trouble that his brother is in either. So he has to sort of work out how to survive in this new world. But he has to go because he's really unhappy living in the city. The great thing about this film is that the title is called Everybody Has a Plan, and nobody in this film has a plan. Like, there's not one single plan. They're just, everybody's making it up as they go along. It's a really great, tight thriller. Like, it's totally oh my god, what's going to happen next? Oh my god, who's around that corner? Oh, you know, there's all of that stuff going on. It's really intricately plotted so that seeds that are sown earlier on come back to haunt you later. And I recommend this one a lot, actually. I think that if you are into films like The Secrets in Their Eyes or I can't think of another example, but it's a great Latin American intelligent thriller with Viggo at his absolute best, I reckon, at the core of it. He's an actor that's got no vanity, it seems to me. Like, he's getting older and he doesn't mind looking older. He's looking a bit rough, and he's got the soul of both of these characters, right, even though they're completely different. It was a really, really pleasant surprise watching this one. Everybody Has a Plan, in Wellington, playing just at a couple of locations, and I'm not sure if it's much wider in Auckland, but I do hope people get a chance to seek it out because it was terrific.
Do you have two words?
I do, and it's Plan A. Mm. Yeah, my two words for Everybody Has a Plan. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Everybody, yeah. Rock your body, yeah. Everybody, yeah. Rock your body
right. Can I just say, in that moment, I too know those dance moves. And used to do them when the song came out, and it was so cool.
It's just a shame that we're not on video now, because we could get you to bust those moves.
Yeah.
Out.
Yeah, there was a guy at my elementary school named Brian who, like, a bunch of people had a crush on, and him and his friend Harj could do the whole dance, and they did it for the talent show one year, and it was amazing.
Indeed,
that moment of stardom just gone.
Yeah, we're going to get you on X Factor next week, New Zealand's Got Talent.
Practice.
In fact, next week on the show, we're going to feature the highlights from the White Lies Q&A, which you can still get tickets for. If you're in Wellington, check out lighthousecinemas.co.nz and click on the White Lies Q&A link. We're going to be talking to Dana Rotberg, the director of the film, Witte Ihimaida, who wrote the novella that the film is based on, and John Psathis, who wrote the music for the film. They're all going to be at the screening. It's at 4 o'clock on, stop me if I'm getting any of these details wrong, guys.
You're absolutely right.
Okay, yeah, 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon at the Lighthouse Cinema on Cuba Street. I'll be hosting the Q&A. We'll be recording it for the show.
Wigan Street off Cuba.
Yeah.
And there will be a link to the website in the show notes.
Indeed. So, yeah, we've got just a few tickets for that left. It'd be good to see as many of you there as possible. And we'll be playing the highlights of that Q&A on the show next week.
There'll also be a book signing afterwards as well.
Oh, right. Terrific.
Yeah. Bring your books.
In next week's show, we will also discuss whether Man of Steel is a super flick or not. And we're going to go and visit the place beyond the pines as well. Gosling is back. All that and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or however you like to get your podcasts. That's the way that the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. We love your feedback, whether it's through the iTunes store or through social media or even postcards on paper.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, where you can get our two-word reviews, and, of course, on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
Okay, the show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. And we're going to play you out with some music from This Is The End. This is the end, indeed. Mm-hmm. Until next week, that's all from me.
Good night from me.
And all from me.